Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It was considered one of the trials of the century. In 1929, the murder trial of Dr. James Howard Snook for the death of Theora Hicks. She was a medical student at OSU, and he a respected professor in the College of Veterinary Medicine and a respected member of the community, for that matter. He was married. He had a young child, a young daughter. But something went awry. Sometime in 1926, he met Theora Hicks. I think she was a stenographer in the veterinarian school, and they hit it off and started a three-year affair. I hesitate to use the word love. My next guest, Diana Britt Franklin, co-wrote a book about the case. It's called The Gold Medal Killer. Diana's going to join us in a few minutes to talk about her book and to talk about the case. It occurred in 1929. It includes everything but the rock and roll. Sex, drugs, no rock and roll. It's been written around before. I think Mike Harden wrote about the book, The Gold Medal Killer, on Sunday in the Columbus Dispatch, if you want to check that out. But Diana co-wrote the book with Nancy Pennell of Dublin. And I guess Diana and I have a little bit of a sort of a shared history with the Columbus Dispatch as well. So I'm eager to trade stories, but maybe not on the air with her when we can. And we'll talk about it. You know, at first when I started to read the book, I thought, well, it's just another murder story. And I'm not big, but what was more interesting about it than anything was the trial that ensued. Just a few weeks after he was charged in the murder of Theora Hicks. So Diana's with us. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Oh, thank
okay.
you.
Okay, thanks. Huh. Thanks for joining us.
Well, it's great to be here.
I was just kind of chatting up the book a little bit, chatting up the story.
Good for you.
Most of it occurs during just a few months in 1929, in 1 year. It was kind of amazing when you think about how we drag these kind of cases out. I should say drag. That's kind of a pejorative. For good reason, they're dragged out. It's called the process, the judicial process. And but why do you think it stands the test of time since 1929?
I'm not sure what the test of time is, but
why it might still be interesting now.
It's 260 days passed from the day of the murder to the day of the execution. And it's hard to find anything like that today in the court system.
Was it common then?
Yes, they tend to dispatch justice more quickly. I can't cite you what the numbers are on the other book I wrote, Anna Marie Hahn, a serial killer in The Goodbye Door, but that was very swift, something like 340 days or so.
And just 28 minutes or 29 minutes to come to a verdict.
Well, most of that, 16 minutes of that was for prayer, not deliberation. It was 16 minutes for prayer for Snook, and followed by 12 minutes of deliberation. The capital murder case, too. It wasn't a traffic violation. It was capital murder.
What was also interesting, and it's in the title, The Gold Medal Killer, is that Dr. Snook was an Olympic champion.
Yes. In fact, he won two gold medals in the 1920 Olympics in Antwerp. He was on the United States shooting team that won the medals. He was quite a marksman, a national-ranked marksman, national champion, international champion, and gold medal winner. But
Didn't do him much good. If you're just joining us, my guest is Diana Britt. She's author and former dispatch reporter and editor. Were you a reporter at the dispatch as well?
No.
Okay, I didn't think so. He was an Olympic champion. He wasn't particularly dashing, though. He doesn't fit any kind of stereotype one might have about an Olympic champion, particularly, you know, a target. You know, a marksman?
Yes.
Yeah.
Pistol shooting.
Pistol shooting. Doesn't seem to fit that category, maybe in my mind.
Well, I don't know what pistol shooters look like.
I don't know, but they seem, I guess they don't seem as, I guess, for lack of a better word, sort of dorky.
He certainly appears dorky in all the photographs that we have of him.
Have you ever seen any candid shots of him or anything that make him look anything but stuffy and academic?
I don't think the brownie was invented then.
Nothing against academics. Well, there were, you know, there were cameras that people had out there because my grandpa had one, and I've seen a lot of photographs he's taken back in those days. But, yeah, everything looks very posed and that sort of thing. There are a lot of shocking elements to the story. Sex and drugs, as I said, everything but rock and roll. But the legal process, as we mentioned earlier, sort of beat them all in my book.
There were so many inconsistencies in the prosecution that today, almost certainly, he would have been convicted of murder today, but not first-degree murder. He would have escaped the chair, I believe.
And he's the only known Olympian to die in an electric chair.
Right.
Sentenced to death.
Right. He's the only one that we know of.
Well, why don't we go back to that night in 1929 and tell us how they met first and what they were doing there in the first place.
She, Theora Hicks, the victim, was, she had secretarial school. She was attending the medical school, and she got a job at the veterinary school, college, where Snook worked. As a full professor. Unfortunately, or fortunately for them, I guess, they met, and he invited her out and gave her a ride home one day, and one thing led to another, and next thing you know, they're lovers, and he has a private love nest where they can go and do
this. Not far from his home.
No. Well, no, it really was. It was surprising that he should do it here. I mean, why not go to Chillicothe or something?
Yeah, right. And he reserved the room or rented the room in his own name.
Right. He thought that he was covering his tracks, but he was just laying clues down all over the place. And one of them being the rental of the room. And he had that love nest. They had a love nest for 3 years.
She had another affair with another guy, or she was dating somebody.
She was dating another fellow. There was talk of marriage. She rejected him, and that fellow went on. Although he lost his job at Ohio State, he was in the agricultural field. He went on to quite a successful career as an expert in agriculture.
They had a 3-year relationship. How did it go bad? What started to go bad with it?
She made many demands on his time and physical prowess, and the crowning coup de grace, if you will, after many months of kind of rocky relationship, she didn't want him away from her side. At least that's the story that came out. And one day he was playing golf at the Scioto Country Club with two friends, and she walked out on the course and demanded he leave the golf game right in the middle of the game. And it was then that he decided he would dispose of her.
How do you, now, I missed that in the book because I see a reference to that she probably sealed her fate that day.
Right.
But I didn't follow his thought process in that regard, that was the last straw for him and that he was going to have to get out of the relationship, or was he going to have to kill her?
Really, the last straw, and his way of dealing with it would be to kill her, get rid of her entirely. And the way he did it was very brutal.
Messy.
And that was on purpose.
Why do you say that?
Because he felt that he believed that if the crime was brutal enough and like it had been done by a fiend, a murderous fiend, that the suspicion would not fall on him, a respected member of the community.
Now, it's not as if he that night, particular night, lured her out to the shooting range where he eventually killed her. That was just going to be another night in their relationship. Didn't it start out that way? Or do you think he intentionally brought her out there that night?
He had the tools to dispatch her, the hammer and the knife, which he used. They were handy right there, so he seized an opportunity, I think.
Okay, because he carried the knife with him all the time.
Right. I don't know that he specifically planned that night, but when they got together and they were out driving, he decided that that was the time.
We're going to take a short break. In the meantime, if you'd like to give us a call and speak with Diana Britt, author of Gold Medal Killer, The Shocking True Story of the Ohio State Professor and Olympic Champion and His Co-Ed Lover, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and drop us a line there. We'll check that out as well. We're talking about a notorious murder and murder trial in 1929, and if you have heard of this before and want to talk about it or have any questions about it, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Get the stories behind the headlines every day on All Things Considered.
I think people that live with brain injuries so often feel like people don't understand what they're dealing with.
The Brain Injury Association advocates for various groups working with veterans.
Most of these folks go through way more just one deployment versus we have in our entire life.
On your drive home, listen to award-winning coverage from the WOSU news team on WOSU 89.7 FM.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. Get the latest information from our station the way you want it, daily, biweekly, or monthly. Go to wosu.org/email and sign up for one of our e-newsletters.
Support for WOSU comes from Cleveland State University's Graduate Certificate in Early Childhood Mental Health Counseling, whose students can utilize online courses. Deadline for the fall cohort is August 1st. Details at EngageCSUOnline.com.
67 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:19 this morning. Sunshine today and a high of 72, a nice Tuesday in central Ohio. Clouds and rain likely tonight, a low of 60 degrees. Showers and thunderstorms likely throughout the day on Wednesday and a high of 80. And then sunny and a high of 84 looking ahead to Thursday. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Diana Britt Franklin. She's author of Gold Medal Killer, The Shocking True Story of the Ohio State Professor and Olympic Champion and His Co-Ed Lover. She co-wrote the book with Nancy Pennell. Why Nancy Pennell? What was her role in this?
Nancy, we were put together by a mutual friend when the friend realized we were both interested in this story and writing a book. Nancy wrote a manuscript 20 years ago, and it was never published. But her connection to the case is rather interesting. Her grandfather was the dean of the veterinary school at the time this occurred, and he lost his job at Ohio State as a result. And Nancy, growing up in the family, always heard about stories about what happened to her grandfather and so forth. She had some letters and original documents and so forth. So we decided to collaborate.
That was Dr. White?
Yes.
And why was he fired? Was that just a sign of the
times?
Because
he knew of this relationship and didn't stop it.
Okay.
And so, that in a nutshell is what happened.
A lot of people knew about the relationship.
Well, yes. Even Snook's wife. She knew that something was going on. She never met Theora Hicks, the victim.
But she said he was a wonderful husband.
She stuck by him. all the way through, right to the very end.
I wanted to talk about Theora Hicks. She's an interesting character. Where did you get most of your material about her? How did you learn what you did know about her?
Most of it came from newspaper accounts and trial transcripts, people talking about her. But her parents came up from Bradenton, Florida, where they had retired. They came up for the trial, and first the investigation and then the trial. And they spoke a lot to the press, often.
But they didn't really know that much about her, did they?
Her parents?
About who she was and what she was like.
Well, they didn't believe she was like...
The way he described.
The way it was described here. I think it's possible she was a nymphomaniac. She demanded sex. She had lovers, even lovers at the same time, not one at a time.
And she took drugs that enhanced...
Well, the drug issue is kind of a murky area.
Okay.
They did experiment with drugs. They were readily available through the veterinary college. It sparked an investigation by the federal... officials as to what was going on at Ohio State generally with drugs. Were they just too available, not under lock and key and so forth? But I think they were just incidental to the relationship between Hicks and Snook.
614-292-8513. Bill, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. In reading your book, Ms. Franklin, I was wondering whether it's possible that Snook lied completely about a lot of things, and that Ms. Hicks wasn't involved in drugs or the kind of sex that he said she was involved in, et cetera. Is there any corroborating evidence for the things he said? Like, for instance, the Marion Myers, who had been her boyfriend before, did he also report the same kind of drug use and the same kind of sex, or was all of this purely from Dr. Snook?
Meyer was not involved in drugs, as far as I know. That never came out. But he did have a interesting sexual relationship with Theora Hicks, which kind of supported what Snook was saying as to the kind of person that she was.
Okay, thank you. And another question. You mentioned in the book that Mrs. Hicks got an audience with the governor, I think, the day before the electrocution.
Mrs. Hicks or Mrs. Snook?
I'm sorry, what?
Mrs. Hicks or Mrs. Snook?
No, I'm sorry, I mean Mrs. Snook.
Okay.
And I'm wondering, is there any record at all of what she said to him and he to her? Is there any record of that conversation?
None that I found, other than references to the meeting and that she was upset and so was the governor.
Say, Bill.
Yes.
What do you find fascinating about this story?
I think what I find fascinating about this story is that there are questions that aren't answered. That all of the evidence seems to come from the extraordinary testimony that Dr. Snook gave, and that testimony seems to me to be problematic in that he didn't give the same testimony every time. He told different stories that varied in different ways. And so it makes me wonder, how would I decide which part of it is true and which isn't? And is it possible that the majority of it's false?
Well, one of the problems in writing historic fiction, historic nonfiction, is that everybody is dead. There's nobody you can get a first-hand account from. So that's how some of these things slip by with no reasonable answer.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. Why did it occur to you to tell this story?
This is one of those Ohio State legends that have been kicking around for years and years, and everybody seemed to know something about it. They knew the name, but they didn't know exactly what how it occurred or what actually did occur. And so I thought, well, I'll take a look closely at it and see if there was a real story there and what unfolded. I think it's a fascinating story.
It is. If you know, in Mike Harden's review of it on Sunday, he talks about the likelihood that Hollywood would ever cast anyone really like Dr. Snook in the role of Dr. Snook, and it made me wonder who you would cast in his...
Jimmy Stewart?
Anyone living.
I don't know.
What about Theora Hicks?
You mean in terms of who would play Theora Hicks? You know, I really haven't given it any thought. Maybe I should.
Maybe. Theora was unusual for a time, no matter what. I mean, she was a medical student.
Right.
She had to be very bright.
I think she was very bright and very energetic and very driven. But she was not very social, according to her roommates. She had few friends, close friends, but she did have the boyfriends, and we know of two, but I don't know that there weren't a number of others.
No one ever came out.
No.
No one ever emerged. No. I never, as you mentioned early, or maybe you didn't, but I never sensed any real love between them, and I was trying to figure out how a three-year relationship could be sustained without more emotional connection.
I think they were exploring. Both of them were exploring one another, exploring various sex acts, if you will. The Art of Love was a book that he purchased for her, and she seemed to devour it. And the book is really not very sexy when you read it.
But back in the day,
apparently it was a hot item. You can only buy it in a brown paper bag, you know. but they just enjoyed each other as sex partners. And when you say that there was no real love, I think that's true, because he never left his wife and his child. And she was playing the field with others.
One of the words that's used to describe her is a sadist. Do you think that's, or that was just based on his testimony?
I think that's what he thought. And I didn't see any sadism in there, really.
The newspapers, I think there were three in town at the time, right?
Yes.
They covered it from stem to stern, except everything but the good stuff.
Because the dirt.
The dirt, because it wouldn't get in the papers at the time.
No, they wouldn't publish it. But it finally, somebody stole the trial transcript, and it's all in the trial transcript. And they published just a little portion where Snook was testifying how he met Theora, what kind of sex they had, and so forth and so on. A copy of that is at the Columbus Public Library for anybody who wants to look at it. But it was sold. It was a hot item on the streets for just a couple of days, 35 cents a copy. And finally, police came along and confiscated all the copies.
You know, I was thinking as I was reading the book, oh, how bad could it be? I mean, seriously, how bad could this be? And then when I got to his testimony, I'm like, wow.
Well, today you hear that on television.
Well, you do, but it was very graphic. And I kind of wondered what the prosecutor was getting at questioning him so much about their sexual relationship.
Embarrassment.
That's...
To put Snook on the spot. To make him look as bad as he possibly could. And I think he did a very good job. And that evidence of that is the fact that the jury took 12 minutes to convict him for murder and put him in the electric chair. That is incredible to me.
And there were appeals.
There were appeals. They went very quickly.
He was convicted or he was sentenced by August.
Yes. And he died in February of 30. It was executed in February 30.
Now, why did Mrs. Snook meet with the governor?
Well, she was hoping her last... The governor, at the end, was the only one who could stay the execution. And she was hoping for some last-minute successful appeal. But he wouldn't do it.
What were the bases for the appeals? It went all the way up to the United States Supreme Court.
Well, there were a number of mistakes made in the trial by the prosecution. The mistakes, I say, based on what we know, how we look at justice today. But they really were not argued successfully before any court, any appeals court at all. And some of the arguments never came up, like the fact that the grand jury, which indicted Snook for murder, there were two relatives of the prosecutor on the, or relations to the prosecutor on the grand jury, including the foreman. Now, you wouldn't get away with that today. There would be instant appeals on that alone.
And there was just one woman on the jury.
Right. On the trial jury, yes.
Right.
Yeah.
What was the advantage of that?
I'm not sure that I don't think there was any advantage, as it turned out.
Well, it was an advantage for the prosecutor.
Yes.
Was the imbalance on the jury more a function of the prosecutor or the defense?
Defense thought that with all men or as many men as possible, they would do better.
They would feel more sense of camaraderie with guy who had
Hey, this is okay if you do it on the sly, you know.
Uh-huh. With someone 20 years younger than you.
Yes.
Helps.
I know this case has all kinds of strange twists and turns, and you look at it today and you say, how could that possibly be? But back then, things were different. You know, you can't compare apples and oranges.
One reaction to the murder does often play out today, and that was the reaction by the parents to the issue of whether or not their daughters were safe on the campus of Ohio State University. And there was a lot of outrage over that. I can see that happening today.
That aspect, of course. In fact, the Snooks sent their daughter to Ohio State. They were from New York City at the time. But they sent their daughter to Ohio State because they thought it would be safe for a young woman like her. She had been brought up and schooled in private schools, so she led rather a cloistered life. But I think once she got her freedom by coming to Columbus and attending Ohio State, she just broke loose.
That's never happened before, has it?
No, never.
She did her undergrad here?
She did some of it.
Okay.
But,
and she did some of her med school or some of her classes at, is it Case Western? Or?
Yes, she did some summer classes up there.
And they continued the affair?
Yes.
Even when she was away?
Both Meyer and Snook, they both continued the affair up in Cleveland.
How did he decide that he wanted to get away from her and get out of the relationship? When she came to the golf course that day? But that was just the straw.
As I said, he felt she had made too many demands on him sexually and personally by denying him or raising a fuss every time he wanted to go to Lebanon, where he was born and raised and where his mother lived, go to Lebanon and spend some time with his mother or do anything with his wife here in Columbus or his child. She always objected to that. So... it got to the point where he said, enough is enough.
But he didn't come right out and say, I want to break up.
Apparently not.
He just started slugging her with a hammer.
Well, she slapped him a few times, knocking his glasses off. sometimes she got violent with him when he wouldn't perform.
And he had given her a gun, a pistol.
Yes.
And he was afraid she was going to use it on him.
Yes, but he knew it didn't work, the pistol.
Right. So when he used that in his self-defense, you know, that this was a matter of self-defense, when they went to check the pistol, they said, well, it doesn't work. He's like, well, yeah, I know.
Yeah. He knew what was coming.
He was very docile, too, throughout most of the trial.
Dour and docile, yeah. He was not a flamboyant character by any means.
Which kind of makes you wonder, what was the attraction in the first place?
I think for her, it was just a way of breaking loose. And the fact that she had a professor in tow, as opposed to a freshman, that gave her stature and some satisfaction, obviously. For him, it was a thrill of a lifetime, I guess, to have a young co-ed at his beck and call. So they both got something out of the relationship. She just got something she really didn't want.
She wasn't bargaining for. We're going to take another break. If you know this story, why don't you help us decide who should play the roles in the movie?
Well, I would just be interested to know if anybody out there knew the family or had any relationship to the family in this case.
If you have any relationship to the family or know anything about them, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can go to the Facebook page, All Sides with Ann Fisher on Facebook. My associate producer, Amy Jurovich, is ready, willing, and waiting for your comments. We'll be right back with All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Your membership with WOSU provides for the great classical music and NPR news you rely on. By supporting WOSU, you support all your trusted local and national news and information, as well as the concerts, arts, and music you love. Is it time to renew your membership? Call 1-866-897-9678 or go online at wosu.org/give. And thank you for your continued support of WOSU.
And you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. In just about 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, hour two of the program will be here, and we'll hear the latest in national politics with NPR's political junkie, political editor Ken Rudin. He joins Ann at 11 o'clock right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. And 67 degrees currently in downtown Columbus at 10:39 this morning. Sunshine today and a high of 72. Clouds and rain tonight, a low of 60 degrees. Showers and thunderstorms are likely for Wednesday and a high of 80. And sunny on Thursday with a high of 85.
Support for WOSU comes from Catco, presenting the comedy The Mystery of Irma Vep, A Penny Dreadful by Charles Ludlam, on stage through June 27th in Studio 2 at the Rife Center. Tickets and more information at catcoistheater.org.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Who should play the roles of Dr. Snook and Theora Hicks in the movie Gold Medal Killer? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or go to All Sides with Ann Fisher on Facebook. And let us know what you think, or if you know something of the family, whatever happened to them, give us a call, 614-292-8513, and all the other ways, contact us. Let us know what you think. I wanted to talk about the gallery at the trial, and the gallery that wasn't at the trial, the hundreds of people waiting out in the hallway trying to get into the gallery. It was shocking what people did to get in to hear the testimony in this case.
Well, once the trial heated up, got underway, there were hundreds of people who lined up more than 24 hours before the doors were to open for the trial. So they would camp out overnight waiting.
It's like a rock concert. People getting tickets.
Exactly.
For,
yeah. Just like a rock concert. I mean, there was no television. There were no rock concerts. So, you know,
there was
this was it. And so the women, most of them would dress up in their Sunday best and their hats and their furs or their finest dress and so forth, and stand for hours in the hall hoping to get one of the 200 seats that went to those in line.
Were these just tacky people, or were these all kinds of people that did
this? All kinds of people. I never found the mayor's wife or anything like that. I never saw any reference to her. But, yeah, and they would come from afar. I mean, they would come from Arkansas and Florida.
Really?
St. Louis, Missouri, throughout Ohio, of course. So, you know, this was a – if you were going on vacation, one of the things you thought about is coming to Columbus to go to the trial for your vacation.
Well, there had to be so much going on. It was 1929. There were other murders around the country. What made this one so shocking, just the characters?
The characters, the fact that there was a professor involved, an Olympic champion involved, a woman killed that was half his age.
All the usual things.
Lots of factors. But once the gallery got a seat, if you got a seat inside, you couldn't necessarily escape from fainting.
What was the record of faintings?
One day?
Yeah.
One day there was 9 women who fainted in the gallery.
But they always came right back.
Not all of them.
Oh, okay.
Most of them came back.
they were revived and returned.
Those standing in the hall always hoped that they would not be revived. And then there was some question. Some women fainted in order to get a seat. So if they fainted, they'd be taken into the courtroom and revived and so forth and given a seat. Well, then that got to be pretty nasty.
A lot of resentment. 614-292-8513. Kathy, you're on the air. Your aunt was a friend of the Snook family. Welcome to the show.
Well, hi there. This is very interesting because I can remember as a little girl hearing my mother talk about Dr. Snooks. And when I say that she was the friend of their families, I'm assuming that she was because she was the school teacher over in Columbus. And was Mrs. Snook, could she have been a school teacher at one time?
Yes, she was.
Well, do you know what school she would have taught at?
Can't.
Well, she had been a teacher in Licking County, hadn't she?
Right. She grew up in Newark and got her degree at Ohio State. And I'm trying to remember the name of the...
Well, my aunt, I think, was a teacher at Linden, if I'm not mistaken.
That's the one where she was.
Okay. Well, that was it because I know Mother and she would... Of course, I was just little when this was... I was born long after 29, but I do remember that being a subject in our family. A lot of times, and of course, you know, I suppose there were so few murders in those days that Enda had to actually know someone. But I can remember that he had, I remember them talking about him having such a nice wardrobe. I mean, he had beautiful clothes. And I think Mrs. Snook had offered them to somebody in the family. I can't remember whether it was maybe to my dad or not or something through Aunt Mary. And Mother said, oh, no. She didn't want anything like that, ma'am. But I just remember that when I heard you were going to be on today, I was so excited because I'd never really heard the whole story. Mother didn't know all the details either. But years later, she still remembered Dr. Snook, although, you know, it was just through my Aunt Mary. But that was it then. That was the connection. I bet you they were teachers together, and that's
right.
How Aunt Mary knew her.
After he was executed, she changed her name. She reverted back to her maiden name.
Well, didn't they have a little girl?
Yes, they did.
Because I know she was older than I was, but I can remember how Mother felt very badly about that little girl.
Her name was changed as well to her mother's maiden name. She went to Wellesley College, got a teaching degree, went to Hawaii to teach in Hawaii. She got married and went to Hawaii. And taught at the same high school where President Barack Obama
is that right?
Attended, yeah.
Isn't that interesting? Well, I'm glad she had a good life.
she did.
Yeah, well, that's great. Well, I thank you very much. It's a real interesting program. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks
for your call, Kathy.
And I will buy your book because I've got to read all the details.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. The name of the book is called Gold Medal Killer: The Shocking True Story of the Ohio State Professor and Olympic Champion and His Co-Ed Lover, by Diana Britt Franklin, and also with Nancy Pennell. Diana is with us today in the studio. If you have a question or comment about the story of Dr. Snook, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or Theora Dix.
Hicks.
I knew I was going to do that. Theora Hicks. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. How did Dr. Snook get involved, become a target, competitive
When he was growing up in Lebanon, Ohio, he had an interest in shooting on his father's farm, where he was born. And all through high school, he shot the rifle primarily. And later he progressed to pistol shooting, but initially it was the rifle. And just did a lot of shooting.
Just had a good eye.
He apparently was a very steady shooter and a very good one.
We're getting some calls and some emails, 614-292-8513. We have an email from John. If you want to send us an email, allsides@wosu.org. John responded to our quest for the movie roles, for the characters. For Dr. Snook, and I completely get this, William H. Macy.
Little short.
That's right. Dr. Snook was very tall, but in terms of that kind of...
Well, you couldn't find a finer actor, in my opinion, but... I'm not sure he quite duplicates Dr. Snook's stature.
And then for the female lead, Theora Hicks, Natalie Portman or Maggie Gyllenhaal?
I'd hate to make a choice.
Those are two good. I'm leaning toward Maggie.
I would think so, but I think you could put anyone in that role and somebody would be able to do something special with it, you know, as an actress. So I agree. Either one of those would be fine. How about Ingrid Bergman? I'm choosing all people who are dead.
They're all dead. Okay, we have a call, 614-292-8513. Jeff, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. My question is... about the author's comment about Dr. Snook having decided to kill Theora Hicks after she confronted him at the golf course. And I just wondered, what's the evidence that you draw that conclusion on?
Trial testimony primarily, both from the playing partners, from the caddies, and from Dr. Snook himself. It all indicated that that was kind of the final straw for him with her.
And that his conclusion was that he would kill her?
Well, he was getting tired of her and didn't know how to get rid of her. She kept popping up in his life, and he obviously had tired of her.
She made quite a scene at the golf course, too.
Yes, she demanded that he leave the golf course on the fifth hole when he was playing with good friends and... I think that was one of the things you don't do if your life is at risk if you do something like that.
I guess you're not a real big golfer, huh, Jeff?
Interesting question.
I wonder, too, about the Leopold and Loeb case, which is before this. I know there are references in the trial testimony from, I think, the prosecutor to the Leopold and Loeb case, where the accused were not convicted, and I wondered if you knew anything about how that case might have impacted perceptions about, you know, not wanting to let murderers go free or receive reduced sentences. Had you encountered anything on that in your reading?
No, it's an interesting question. I don't have anything in hand that would indicate that. It certainly is logical. Good for you.
It's the same. There's another case in California about the same time that I think it's called the Wineville Chicken Ranch killings. That the basis of the movie The Changeling and the Leopold and Loeb argument figured into that trial as well, and was kind of used to judge people were sort of against the killer, I guess, more than they might have been because of these perceptions. So I wondered if you'd seen anything on that. But thanks. I'm looking forward to reading the book.
Thank you very
thanks,
much.
Thanks, Jeff.
Bye-bye.
You know, one of the characters in the book that stands out, of course, is John Chester. He was the prosecutor in the case. And there was speculation or, you know, suggestion that this guy, he was an attractive, smart, kind of charismatic personality, probably had a nice political future ahead of him. Lord knows plenty of prosecutors have sought higher office, but he never really went anywhere.
No. And the suggestion was that he suffered from some of the backlash of having pressed so hard on this case and bringing out all this raunchy testimony, the dirt, so to speak, which the public, some of the public, resented. And they didn't want to read that. Well, they didn't read it, but there was. And so he didn't really gain anything at all having successfully prosecuted Snook.
Now, part of his successful prosecution derived from the confession that he got out of Snook over like a 10 or 12 hour period.
22 hours.
22. Oh, well, twice as long. Okay. In the ballpark. But
yeah, and
that got pretty rough.
And yeah, at one point during the interrogation of Snook, Chester slapped Snook across the face several times, knocking off his glasses, trying to get him to confess. And eventually Snook did confess, but it was one of four or five different stories that Snook confessed to. So what the true story was, I think the book kind of comes down in the correctness of what he did. And the last confession that he gave, his so-called confession, was the one to the warden at the Ohio Penitentiary.
I thought it was interesting at the end of the book how you wrap up where everybody went, including Snook's Ford. It wasn't a sedan, it was a coupe.
Coupe. Still in town.
It's still out there,
still
folks.
Still in town, and if I get the right situation to do a book signing, they'll bring the car to the book signing. Still there.
Was it collected as a collector's?
Yes.
It was purchased at the time.
It originally was in the hands of the Schrödinger family. And
of funeral.
Funeral homes. Recognition, mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
But not anymore.
No, it was sold several years ago to another collector.
Who bought it because of its background.
Of course.
It's nothing otherwise special about it.
It's been restored. The seats were all ripped up looking for evidence and so forth. There was some damage done by the investigators. But basically the same car, and if you think you could have sex in the front seat of that car, you're sadly mistaken.
Well, I'll tell you, his description of doing it, though, was painful just to read.
It really was.
And was it not just because literally you wondered how they could do it, but just because he kept going back and forth and changing. Well, my foot was in the car. No, I guess it was outside the car, and the prosecutor seemed to be having a heyday him on that one.
As I said in the book, it was kind of the hokey pokey, one foot in, one foot
exactly.
out.
We're talking about the book, Gold Medal Killer, with the author, Diana Britt Franklin, who co-wrote the book with Nancy Pennell. Also, you talk about the rifle range, the New York Central Rifle Range, where she was murdered, is now the Columbus Police Department firing range.
They own the property, and they have several facilities. They don't really use the firing range anymore, they use it for other programs that they have.
The Snook home was on West 10th Avenue. It was torn down years ago to make way for enlarging the University Hospital Complex.
Right.
Why did you do this? Why at the end of the book did you go through and, even though I guess I found it interesting, so obviously, you know, there's appeal, but why was that?
Well, I have received more calls since this book came out about how much people enjoyed the epilogue and tying everything up. And I think that's why I did it, because there were a lot of loose ends of what happened to Mrs. Snook, what happened to the child, and so forth. And so I think they're kind of fun to do.
It was. It was fun to read. It was an interesting book, and I enjoyed reading it. One caller says it's not at Barnes & Noble. Where can you get the book?
Borders is going to start ordering, and the book just came out, so we haven't got Barnes & Noble on board yet, but Borders is.
Okay.
And
online, of course.
Online and direct through the publisher, Marquette Books.
Diana Britt Franklin, thanks so much for being with me today. We've run out of time.
Wonderful.
Appreciate it. Diana Britt Franklin, author of Gold Medal Killer, The Shocking True Story of the Ohio State Professor and Olympic Champion and His Co-Ed Lover. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Linda Greenlaw is the nation's only female swordfish boat captain. She commands a salty crew battling storms and sharks to catch fish weighing hundreds of pounds each. How does she do it?
Well, most guys, especially fishermen, have respect for someone who works hard. The bottom line is, can I make them a paycheck?
Linda Greenlaw on the next Fresh Air. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
See a new lineup of public affairs programming Friday nights from WOSU-TV. Starting at 8 is Washington Week, followed by Columbus on the Record at 8:30. Continuing at 9 is the McLaughlin Group. And at 9:30, PBS presents Need to Know, a new program with an innovative broadcast and web approach to news gathering. Watch the new public affairs lineup every Friday night beginning at 8 on WOSU-TV. 69 degrees currently in downtown Columbus. Sun and clouds today, a high of 72. Good morning from WOSU. Politics are everywhere. They're in the Gulf of Mexico, where thousands of gallons of oil continue to escape from the leaking pipe. They're in the world of the so-called Dean of the White House Press Corps, Helen Thomas. They're in the heartland, where the campaign season is starting to warm up for the summer. They're in health care reform and immigration reform, and well, pick your reform, you'll find some politics. That's why we'll always need the political junkie Ken Rudin around. NPR's political editor stays abreast of such things so that the rest of us can just sit back and enjoy the ride. Join us in a few minutes with Ken Rudin on All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.